of the fact that we won't have a class during Reading Week, which is on February, the week of February 20th. Okay, so what I wanted to do today to finish off the discussion on the null case for Judy's incongruences was to talk about the condition for hypersurface orthogonality. I've alluded to that already a little bit, but I want to come back to that and do that in some detail. And then we'll look into the Ray-Chowdhury equation and the focusing theorem in this context of null congruences. But more or less all of that is going to be, you know, almost identical to what we did in the time-like case, so there are no additional subtleties that are, you know, associated with the null situation. So let's look into a hypersurface orthogonal. Congruence, and here the meaning, of course, has to be adapted from what we normally mean, you know, what we would mean in the time-like case. In the time-like case, we would be talking about space-like hypersurfaces to which all the geodesics are actually orthogonal in the usual sense of the word. Here we're talking about, well, what happens in the limiting situation, and what happens in the limiting situation is that, well, we have a family of hypersurfaces, and our null geodesics are actually within the hypersurface. That's what happens in the limit. So we have our geodesics, we have the null vector k, which is tangent to the geodesics. It's also normal to the surface, but k is orthogonal to itself, as always, so we have the normal vector being tangent to the surface also. So that's the situation, and if it's going to be true, so what we can do here is to introduce a description for the surface, which is the statement that some function of the coordinates in space-time is going to be equal to a constant. And if we vary the constant, we go from one hypersurface to the next, each one being null. And if we want to construct the normal to that set of surfaces, what we have to do is to construct the gradient of the function phi. You know, that's just a repetition from what we had done before. So the normal vector, if we don't worry about the normalization, the normal vector is going to be just the gradient of the function, because the function only changes if we go off the hypersurface, so the normal will be in the direction of the gradient of the function. And this is going to be a null vector by virtue of the fact that we're dealing with a null surface. And because it's a null vector, we don't have to worry about its normalization. So I might as well take k to be equal to the gradient of phi. So not having to worry about normalization tells us that we can just take k to be equal to the gradient. In the time-like case, we had to make sure that the normalization was, you know, just so. So we had to introduce a coefficient in front, but here we don't have to do that. So the statement of hypersurface orthogonality is just a statement that our tangent vector field can be expressed as the gradient of some scalar function. And there are all sorts of neat consequences associated with that equation, and I tried to go through some of that misguidedly when I was talking about the time-like case, but I want to repeat that calculation I was trying to do in that case, and I had to give up on that because it was wrong. You may or may not remember that. Hopefully you won't remember. If you don't remember and you're interested, you can go back online now. It's all there for posterity, unfortunately. But anyway, now I'm going to give you the correct version of that calculation I was trying to do before. What I want to say first is that if I have a vector which is null, which is the gradient of some function, then it's guaranteed that this vector will satisfy the geodesic equation in a fine parameter form. It's just an immediate consequence, and we can just verify that. What I'm trying to prove is that this vector k defined in such a way and with the understanding that it's a null vector, because we're dealing with a null surface, automatically satisfies the geodesic equation. So when we go back to the, you know, when we move forward later today and start talking about hypersurfaces, one statement that comes with, you know, when you have null hypersurfaces is the fact that null hypersurfaces will always have a network of geodesics tangent to it, and those will be null geodesics that essentially define the surface. So we call, you know, the meaning of hypersurface orthogonal really means that here the surface is actually generated by the null geodesics. Those are surface forming as opposed to being orthogonal in the usual sense of the word. So we're talking about surface forming geodesics or surface generating geodesics, and the null geodesics are normally called the null generators of that hypersurface. So I'll start using this language a little bit later. But anyway, let's verify that this satisfies the geodesic equation. So, so one thing that we know is that the vector is null, which means that the squared gradient of the function phi is zero. So that's an important statement. And we'll use that. So what I want to calculate is this quantity right here. And the gradient of the tangent vector field, you know, gives me two derivatives of the surface phi, and that and this one, of course, gives me another derivative of the function phi. And here's what I was trying to do before. We'll interchange the order of differentiation because we have two derivatives acting on a scalar function. This is an operation that actually commutes. So we can rewrite this as this, and then what we can do from here is to recognize that this can be rewritten in this form where we let alpha, the alpha derivative, differentiate both terms, and we pick up twice the same thing when we do that using the product rule, and we pick up two terms like that. And at this stage, we're done because we know that everywhere where the congruence is defined, we have a stack of null surfaces, and therefore the null condition on the gradient vector is going to be satisfied, so the zero can be differentiated, and it would give you zero. And the bottom line is that we do get the geodesic equation in the usual affine parameter form. So when you have a hypersurface orthogonal congruence of null geodesics, you can always write the tangent vector to the congruence is going to be equal to a gradient. That makes k the normal vector to the null hypersurfaces. And this by itself is compatible with the requirement that k should be satisfying the geodesic equation and that the congruence should be affinely parametrized. All of those statements are, in fact, you know, all part of the same package. And this is, you know, this is all a consequence of making this assignment and, of course, remembering that we're dealing here with a null vector. So we have an automatic enforcement of the geodesic equation. And when we go a little bit beyond this, well, we're going to see that this also gives us the statement that the rotation tensor for the for the null congruence has to vanish. So this equation right here also has a consequence, as a consequence, the statement that omega has to vanish, the omega tensor has to vanish. And I'll prove this part of the theorem, but it works in both ways. So a necessary and sufficient condition for the congruence to be hypersurface orthogonal is that if you calculate the rotation tensor given the tangent vector field, if you find that it's zero, then you can find a scalar function such that this is true, and that means that your hypersurface is actually, your congruence is actually hypersurface orthogonal. So let's go through the, you know, the steps involved in proving this. I mean, they're very simple, but we have to do all, you know, all the projection stuff that was left, that was part of this of the discussion this morning. So what I want to do is to calculate B tilde in the case where k can be, can be made equal to a gradient. And what we have to do here is to remember that B tilde is obtained after projection of B itself, and B itself is given by the gradient of the velocity, the gradient of the tangent vector field. So what we have to do is to put all the ingredients together and just do the computation. So So let's do it. So what I'll do is to expand one of the projection operators to make it fully explicit. So we have the metric, we have k beta n nu, and then we have n beta k nu. And all of that is going to be acting on k mu, differentiated with respect to nu. And immediately we see that we can kill off that term because we have the geodesic equation. So we end up with two terms. One giving us k beta differentiated with respect to, so k mu differentiated with respect to beta. And then we have this additional term in the direction of k, which involves the derivative of k in the direction of n. Okay, so now I'm going to make this one explicit. And we're going to have k alpha n mu, and then n alpha k mu, and that will multiply all of that. And now we have to work on this. This term is not going to contribute because when I multiply k to this, we get zero for the usual reason. So we can get rid of this term, and we can also get rid of it here for exactly the same reason. K multiplying all of this over here will involve, you know, the norm of k being differentiated, so we can kill that. So this doesn't contribute, but we get everything else that comes from those two terms over here. So here we get k alpha differentiated with respect to beta. And then I need to act on this, so we're going to get k beta acting on the derivative of k in the direction of n. So I've got those two terms, and now I'm going to have this term over here, which gives me k alpha k mu derivative with respect to beta in the direction of n. And finally, we get k, those two terms added together, multiplied together, so we get k alpha k beta, and then we get k mu nu n mu n nu. All right, so we get a longish expression for b tilde, which is all of that. So at this point, I haven't assumed anything. I haven't assumed anything about the congruence being hypersurface orthogonal. So that, in fact, is it's a general expression for B tilde, which I actually quote in the notes somewhere. Okay. So that's quite general. But now what I'm going to do is to specialize it to the case where we do have hypersurface orthogonality. And what we're going to see when we make this assumption, when we put in that condition, is the fact that this tensor will turn out to be symmetric. And that's going to mean that its antisymmetric piece, of course, will vanish. So there's not much more that we need to do here. We just need to plug in our expression for k as a gradient. Move this down. So with k alpha being the gradient of the scalar function, what we have then is that b tilde is going to be, first of all, k differentiated, which is the scalar function differentiated, and we recognize that this term is symmetric. Then we have k beta. K beta, I'll just leave it as k beta. And what we have then is phi differentiated with respect to alpha, then mu, in the direction of n. Then we have k alpha. And here we have phi And we first differentiate with respect to mu, then beta, then multiply by n. And finally, we have, well, k alpha, k beta, which is symmetric, so we don't need to work on that. And well, the point is that here, so we know that this is symmetric, so what I can do here is to exchange the order of the indices. And when I do have, when I do that, when I compare those two terms and I look at what happens when I exchange beta and make it alpha, so when I symmetrize with this, so when I interchange alpha and beta in those two terms, this term will go into that one will go into this one, and those two terms together are symmetric in alpha and beta. And bottom line is that, you know, everything on the right-hand side is symmetric under an exchange of alpha and beta, which means that beta tilde, b tilde, is fully symmetric. And, well, that implies, of course, that the antisymmetric piece, which is the rotation tensor, that implies that it's zero. So what we have then is the connection between the statement that we have a congruence which is hypersurface orthogonal in the sense of being hypersurface forming, implying that the rotation tensor is zero. So in the time-like case, the proof was a little bit clumsier than this because we had to put a factor in front of the gradient operator. But here we don't have to, you know, we don't need that factor. In fact, we don't want it. And because of that, the proof is, is more straightforward. The only, you know, the only thing we do need to do here, which we didn't have to do before, is all the business of doing the projections. But, you know, that can be done without, you know, any trouble at all. So here we have the statement that if we have the condition that the congruence is hypersurface orthogonal, we have the rotation tensor vanishing, and the statement is that, well, this can be proved also in the opposite direction at the price of more fancy work, which I don't care to do here. Bottom line is that we'll have a hypersurface orthogonal congruence if the rotation tensor is zero. In the time-like case, there was a substantial loss of generality in going in assuming that the congruence should be hypersurface orthogonal. I mean, that happens in certain situations, like, you know, in the Friedman-Robinson-Walker cosmology, where the, you know, the word lines of the cosmological fluids are geodesics and they are orthogonal to surfaces of constant time. So this is a situation where we do have a hypersurface orthogonal congruence, but, you know, this is a situation that has a lot of symmetries built in. It turns out that in the null case, the condition on, you know, the requirement that the congruence should be hypersurface orthogonal turns out to be much more plausible from a physical point of view and represents less of a loss of generality, although it is a loss of generality. Not all null congruences have to be hypersurface orthogonal. There are well-known ones that are not hypersurface orthogonal, but I'll give you an argument later why the hypersurface orthogonality is something that you should expect null congruences typically to have, and we'll see why in a second. And it has to do with the fact that, well, I'll give you the argument a little bit later. Okay, so we have that. The reason why I need to mention this condition on hypersurface orthogonality is that this is going to be something that will be entering the formulation of the focusing theorem. And I'll formulate that, as soon as I have the Ray-Chowdhury equation all derived. So I want to do that first, then I'll talk about the focusing theorem, and I want to return to those issues after I'm done with that. So any questions about what's happened here? It's all good? All right. Okay, the Ray-Chowdhury equation is the evolution equation for the expansion. So this morning we saw that the expansion measures the rate of fractional change in the cross-sectional areas of the congruence, and that's something that we would like to understand a little bit better. And we can do that by putting in how the expansion evolves as a function of the affine parameter on the reference null geodesic. And the derivation here proceeds in exactly the same way that it did in the time-like case. We don't need to alter any steps except for the final one. So I'll indicate that, but you can go through exactly the same procedure without having to change anything. And the idea is that, well, theta can be, so it's defined as the trace of B tilde, but as we saw, the trace of B tilde is the same thing as the trace of B itself, which is the same thing as the divergence of the tangent vector field. So that was true in the time-like case. It remains true in the null case, which means that, you know, the evolution equation that you'll derive for theta, well, proceeds in exactly the same way. So what you get then when you follow those steps is an equation that gives you the rate of change of theta along the congruence. The rate of change now is defined with respect to the affine parameter on the null geodesic. So before we were working in terms of proper time, here we work in terms of the null affine parameter. But the right-hand side of the equation that we got before is the same that what we find here. And we get the same B squared term that we got for the time-like case, and we get the same Ricci term that we got for the time-like case. So this equation, the derivation of this equation, is the same as in the time-like case. And that was the hard part of the calculation. That involves, you know, commuting covariant derivatives and doing things like that. So to get there was the hard part. And what remains to be done for the null case is to re-express B in terms of B tilde. And, you know, just carry out the decomposition in terms of irreducible pieces and all of that. So we have B here. We can re-express it in terms of B tilde. So this is B. This is B tilde. So you can, you know, literally express B in terms of B tilde. But what we're interested in doing is to take the square of B. And all sorts of wonderful things happen when you take the square of this. So B tilde and B, the difference between the two is a bit of a mess. But notice that the difference is either proportional to K beta or K alpha or both. And K is orthogonal to this. So when you square, so for example, suppose that you're going to square B tilde. Well, you're going to get the square of that first. So that will be left alone. That's the square of B. And then you'll get all sorts of cross terms, which will involve, for example, this multiplying that, which is 0, this multiplying this, which is 0, this multiplying that, which is 0, this multiplying itself, which is 0, and so on and so forth. So when you put it all together, you find that the square of B tilde is exactly the same as the square of B. All of the additional terms don't contribute at all because they're all proportional to a null vector, and or proportional to something which will become 0 after using the geodesic equation or the normalization condition or both or none, or, you know, so bottom line is that in the end you end up with something very simple. So after doing all of this, you end up with exactly the same expression, but now in terms of B tilde. And here we use the decomposition in terms of expansion, shear, and rotation. We square that, but again, there's no cross terms because of all the symmetry properties and because, you know, we have an irreducible decomposition of these things. So the square of B in the end will involve a square of the expansion, a square of the shear, a square of the rotation, as we had in a time-like case, without interference between all of those terms. So when we put it all together, we find that the final equation for the rate of evolution of the expansion is as follows. In the time-like case, we had this as minus a third theta squared. And again, you know, we changed the numerical factor because of, you know, three dimensions going into two dimensions. So that's the same story here. So we get minus a half theta squared. We get minus the square of the shear tensor. We get plus the square of the rotation tensor. And then we get the Ricci term. And this is the null version of the Ricciardi equation. And that's going to be the basis with which we're going to prove the focusing theorem. And the focusing theorem will be obtained by killing that term, which contributes a positive thing when everything else is negative. And we're going to place some condition on the Ricci term to be sure that this also comes with a negative sign. And the focusing theorem here will have exactly the same statement as in the time-like case. It's going to be a statement to the effect that this can only be negative. So that if you have an expanding congruence, it's got to slow down as it expands. If you have a contracting congruence, it's got to speed up as it continues to contract. Same formulation, except that, the conditions placed on the Ricci tensor are a bit more natural in this case, as we're going to see. And the condition of hypersurface orthogonality, as I said before, I think has a more natural physical underpinning, which I'll explain in a second. One thing that I should say now is the fact that this equation is completely independent of n. It's not obvious. We know that theta itself is independent of n. So this term, of course, also will be independent of n. What is not obvious is that both of these terms over here are going to be independent of n. And here you'll have to take my word for it until you work through the exercise yourself for the next homework assignment. And what you're going to be showing in that case, as I told you this morning, is that if you make a different choice for the additional null vector n, what's going to happen is that, well, the expansion is going to stay invariant, as we saw. The shear tensor, the components of the shear tensor, are going to change if you change n. So sigma all by itself, transforms in a certain way that you're going to work out if you change n and make it something else. However, the square of sigma is invariant. And same thing for the rotation tensor. The rotation tensor will change under a change of n of null vector field. But the square of sigma will be invariant. There's nothing obvious about this, but it's a fact. And that can be proved by just going through the exercise of looking at all possible transformations on n that are allowed, that will preserve the conditions that we wish to place on n, and just making, you know, seeing how the transformation affects various things, and concluding that, as I said, the square of sigma and the square of omega is invariant. You have a question?
Does that also mean that the dynamics of shear and rotation will depend on n? And so the only meaningful equations you can write about dynamics of shear and rotation is have to do with the square.
No, I wouldn't say that, because if you were to write down an equation of evolution for sigma and omega, the form of the equation would be invariant, but each term in the equation would change, you know, in a specific way under a change of n. So you don't change the form of the equation, and each term in the equation has a transformation property under a change of n. So the equation is still meaningful, it's just that what each term is in the equation will depend on your choice of n. So it's a sort of, it's not a tensorial transformation, but it's one of those sort of gauge type transformations that preserve the form of the equations, even though each term in the equation does change under the transformation. So you'll work it out. And I won't write down the evolution equations for the shear and the rotation tensor, but that's something that I also do as an exercise in the book. So if you're really curious, you can work it all out and see how it goes. Was there another question? Another thing that that I wanted to point out is the fact that those tensors, as we've defined them, are, you know, defined purely in the transverse direction, right? So we wrote down this decomposition of B tilde in terms of a trace part, and then a symmetric trace-free part, and a rotation part, and an antisymmetric part. This was, of course, you know, built in such a way that it would be purely transverse, orthogonal to both K and N, and that has to be true for each term in the decomposition. So this was guaranteed. This is also orthogonal to both K and N, and that's going to be true also for sigma and omega. So those tensors can be thought of as, you know, tensors that have components purely in the transverse directions. They're essentially two-dimensional spatial tensors. And what that guarantees is that, well, the square of sigma has to be positive or zero, cannot be negative, and the square of omega, same thing. It can also, you know, it can only be positive or zero. So the square of omega is an invariant under a change of auxiliary null vector field N. If it's zero for one choice, and the square of the quantity is zero for that choice, it must be zero for any other choice. So the statement that the congruence is hypersurface orthogonal, of course, when you write it like that, it's obvious that there's no dependence on N. But the statement that omega vanishes is also something that is N invariant under a change of N. If you find that omega is zero under one choice, it's going to be zero under all possible choices. So that's all coming back to this notion that even though there's an ambiguity involved in choosing N, there's a non-uniqueness involved in that construction. In the end, the importance of that is very limited. I mean, there's very little, you know, there's no obstacle, there's no problems, there's no really bad aspects associated with that non-uniqueness. It all works out for itself. And in the end, you end up with an equation like this, which is completely N invariant, or you end up with evolution equations for the shear and omega, which are, in a sense, covariant under changes of N. So the whole thing is very well protected against this, you know, potential problem of having non-uniqueness and ambiguities built in. Okay, so what's the focusing theorem? Well, we're going to assume two things. We're going to assume that we have a congruence which is hypersurface orthogonal. And that means that the rotation tensor is zero, whatever choice you make for N. And we're going to assume what is called the null energy condition. And the null energy condition guarantees that the Ricci term with the minus sign is negative, which means that this combination of things is positive. The null energy condition says that the KK component of the Ricci tensor has to be non-negative. What does it mean? Well, you know, as far as the Ray-Chowdhury equation is concerned, it's really a condition on the geometry, on, you know, the Ricci tensor in the spacetime. If we involve the Einstein field equations, that will become a condition on the energy momentum tensor. We can express R in terms of the energy momentum tensor and its trace. And we get this condition. And in the time-like case, that gave rise to the strong energy condition, which was a little bit strange and clumsy because of the appearance of the trace term in it. If we didn't have the trace term in it, this contracted with a time-like vector would be the energy density as measured by an observer moving with that for velocity. In the time-like case, that was the situation. In the null case, well, the trace term doesn't appear because the trace term involves the length of the k vector, and that's zero. So in the null case, we can get rid of that. And what we get here is a condition on T mu nu all by itself. And the physical interpretation of this is something like this. Let's look at this condition as an approach from the time-like direction into the null limit. So let's look at this equation in terms of a time-like vector instead of a null vector. Well, if we make k time-like and we look at this, we're looking at the component of the energy momentum tensor. If we're looking at the time-time component of the energy momentum tensor as seen by an observer moving with that four velocity that is aligned, you know, that's aligned with that time-like k. So before we take the limit, we have the energy momentum tensor or the energy density of whatever lives in the space-time as measured by that observer. So we're talking about a time-like observer, and we're saying that energy density as measured by that observer should be positive. And that's a sort of sensible, meaningful, sort of plausible condition you might want to put on matter living in space-time. If we were dealing with a time-like case, we would call that the weak energy condition. That's the weakest form of energy condition. You're only demanding that the energy density be positive, and you don't care about pressure. The weak energy condition would be a condition on the energy momentum tensor for arbitrary observers. Arbitrary time-like observers, they could be moving as fast as you want them to. The energy condition has to be satisfied. So for any observer moving at whatever speed, you would have to satisfy the condition. So the observer could be moving at almost the speed of light and still be time-like, and the energy condition would still have to be satisfied. And what we do here is to just take the limit of that, where we take the observer to go all the way to the speed of light. And we're just assuming, essentially, that nothing surprising happens in the limit where, you know, the component of the energy momentum tensor that would be measured by that observer, you know, still has that positivity requirement as you go all the way to the limit. So you can be just a little bit away from the speed of light and measure positive energy. And as you take the limit, well, you don't really talk about measured energy anymore. You're not talking about observers anymore. But you're talking about the same component of the energy momentum tensor preserving its sign as you take the limit. So that's the meaning of the null energy condition. It's essentially a limiting case of the weak energy condition when you allow the time-like vector field, which can be arbitrary, to also be null. So you include the null case as, you include the null case together with all the time-like possibilities. So that's the null energy condition. That's a much weaker condition than one we had to impose in the time-like case, which was the strong energy condition, which involved the pressures and all that. And that's one reason why the null version of the focusing theorem is much more powerful, because the assumptions you need to place on it are weaker than what we needed to do in the time-like case. So that's why, in the end, the null version of the focusing theorem is stronger in terms of physical impact. Okay, so once you have those assumptions, well, what you find is that in the Reichert-Urey equation, this goes to zero, and every term on the right-hand side comes with a negative sign. So this is a positive quantity with a negative sign, positive quantity with a negative sign, positive quantity with a negative sign, and that guarantees that the congruence, that the expansion of the congruence will decrease in time. So the congruence can be expanding, in which case theta would be positive, but it's going to become less positive, theta will decrease as you follow the motion of the congruence, which means that the rate of expansion will decrease in time. So that's the expansion of the congruence slowing down during the evolution of the congruence. If it's starting to contract, if it's contracting, then theta would be negative, and the magnitude of theta would increase in time. Theta would become increasingly negative. So if the congruence is contracting, it's going to speed up as it contracts. And what happens then is that if you have a congruence which starts out contracting, there's going to be a point where you're going to start forming caustics. That is the same story that what we had in the time-like case. So an initially contracting congruence we'll have to keep on contracting all the way, and eventually it will form focal points, or more generally, caustics. So if it starts contracting, there's really nothing you can do unless you violate the energy condition to make it turn around. And that's, you know, another reason why you cannot have a Phoenix universe or a wormhole or a non-singular black hole without having to introduce, you know, serious amounts of negative energy to turn the contracting behavior of the congruence into something expanding again. If it's contracting, it's going to keep on contracting until you start forming singularities in the evolution of the congruence. Yep?
There's no path of time here.
No.
So how do I, when you talk about what will happen in time, how do I know that land is associated with time?
That's a very good question. So I'm talking about time, but really I'm talking about a fine parameter distance along the null geodesics, which is the only notion of time I have available here. But you're asking a very good question, because you might ask, you know, how is that flow of time related to the flow of time that any other observer would measure? So for example, you're a time-like observer in space-time, you're observing that congruence of null geodesics, and you look at that using your own proper time. And the question might be, you know, is the flow of time in lambda simply related to the flow of time of your proper time? And the answer is, well, maybe, maybe not. It really depends on the nature of the space-time. And in fact, that gives me a chance to talk about something that was actually pretty interesting that happened fairly recently. I'll try to tell the story correctly. There's a solution to the five-dimensional Einstein field equations that corresponds to a Schwarzschild black hole extended in a fifth dimension, and it's called the black hole string, or the black string. So you just write down the Schwarzschild solution and you add a dz squared to the line element, and that becomes a five-dimensional solution, and it's a solution to the Einstein field equations in five dimensions. And what you have essentially is a four-dimensional black hole that extends in the fifth direction as a tube. So that's the string. Ray Laflamme, who's famous from the IQC, had a prior life as a relativist. And he and Ruth Gregory figured out a long time ago that there was an instability associated with the black string. There was a gravitational instability associated with the black string that corresponds to the tube, the string, essentially. The instability mode is one where you contract the tube together with an elongation. You stretch it and you shrink it down. And they were able to, so they showed that this instability exists. They couldn't follow the evolution of the instability because they had, you know, they only did a perturbation analysis of this, but they could tell that, you know, this potentially could lead to a runaway process where perhaps, in fact, the black tube, the black string would actually fragment and form perhaps a string of black holes instead of one long tube. But the endpoint of the instability was actually what was unknown up until, well, it's still unknown. People have been working on this and trying to identify what it is. If it's true that you can collapse your black string into a string of black holes, that's really bad for black hole, for all the theorems that are known about black holes, because one theorem that was due to Hawking that should be valid in five dimensions just as well as in four dimensions is that black holes cannot bifurcate and they cannot pinch off, and the event horizon cannot change topology after formation. So if the black hole instability ends up with a bunch of black holes, it means that, well, all of our cherished beliefs about black hole behavior, even in four dimensions, could be in need of revision and all of that. So to understand the nature of the black hole, of the black string instability, and how it turned out to be a pretty important question, even though it's in five dimensions and, you know, sensible people don't live in five dimensions. I know I'm offending at least one person here. So the reason I'm telling you this is because, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, Gary Horowitz proved the theorem with colleagues that showed that if the black tube actually pinches off, it has to take place in an infinite amount of time. So there was so he was able to prove a theorem, and with some assumptions that looked pretty reasonable, but he showed that if it's possible for the Gregory-Laflamme instability to actually produce, you know, a stretching of the tube and a contraction of the tube all the way down to a pinch off, this would have to happen in an infinite amount of time. Which time were they talking about? A fine parameter time. How is a fine parameter time related to external time in that space-time? Well, there's an exponential relationship, and the exponent is related to the surface gravity of the black string, which is dynamically changing as the black string evolves. So in fact, in that case, it was possible to come up with a possibility where pinch off in infinite fine parameter time could still proceed in finite external time. And therefore, it's possible to respect the theorem while still producing a pinch off that would be visible to external observers at finite time. So that was a long-winded story, but the point is that, to answer your question, is not obvious. It really depends on the nature of the space-time. And when the theorem was first proposed, a lot of people, including Gary, said, well, it rules out any possibility for the Gregory-Laflamme instability from producing a string of black holes. And it took a lot of thought and, you know, to actually turn that in, well, to show that the argument was a little bit subtle and inconclusive, because there's no guarantee that a fine parameter time relates simply to external time. The exponential relationship between external time and a fine parameter time is something that is always, I mean, that's a very common feature of black holes. So whenever you have the event horizon and you have null geodesics defining the surface of the event horizon, the affine parameter on the event horizon is in fact exponentially related to external time. So that's something that we'll see later on when we talk about black holes. Okay, any other questions about? Yep.
Just one question about the null energy condition. You were saying that it's in some sense weaker than the weak energy condition in the time-like case. But at the same time, you can justify it on the basis of continuity argument from the time-like case.
I don't think I was trying to suggest that this is weaker than the weak energy condition, because I really do see it as just a limiting case. But I did wanted to say that it was weaker than the strong energy condition. Not in the sense that strong implies weak, so it's not true in this case. Nevertheless, there's more built into the strong energy condition than in the weak energy condition, and this is just a limiting case of the weak energy condition. So. Okay, so the message here is that, well, we have a focusing theorem which involves a slightly milder assumption than in the time-like case, but all the physical impact and all the sort of intuition that comes from the focusing theorem that I told you about last time, you know, the all the aspects involving, you know, congruences that would turn around and start expanding after they have been contracting, all of those space-times that have those features, like wormhole space-times, need to involve a violation of the weak energy condition, because otherwise you would violate the focusing theorem. And, well, there's very little opportunity to do that. Another way of achieving this, of course, is to turn on the rotation. And, of course, if you have enough vorticity, you can, in fact, you know, make the right-hand side dominate over all the other negative contributions. And that's a way out of the focusing theorem. And here's where I wanted to come back and tell you why this is a fairly... you know, a fairly plausible assumption to have orthogonal, the hypersurface orthogonality, thank you, condition. And the justification for this simply has to do with, you know, what is moving on a null geodesic? I mean, we are thinking of null geodesics as being the path of photons, What do we mean by that? I mean, all that we mean really is that null geodesics are the path of light rays. And what are light rays? Well, they're solutions to Maxwell's equations corresponding to a situation where the wavelength of your radiation is much smaller than any other scale in the problem, including the radius of curvature of your spacetime in which it moves. So when do you expect electromagnetic fields to behave as radiation? When do you expect gravitational electromagnetic waves to propagate on null geodesics? Well, it's when you have this condition of geometric optics being verified, which is to say that you have a wavelength for the radiation which is very short compared with any other scale, including the radius of curvature in the spacetime. So what I want to show you here, and I'll just do something very, very rough, very quick, very crude, but I just want to show you that, you know, if you are talking about a wave field in a geometric optics limit, you will find that that the congruence of null geodesics that this defines is hypersurface orthogonal. And, well, in fact, the calculation is very simple. So let's just talk a little bit about geometric optics, again, in a very quick sense. I mean, in previous years, I was doing a very detailed presentation of this. I don't think it's necessary. What is geometric optics? Well, it's when you go from wave optics to a description where you only have light rays. And in, you know, flat space, you have, you know, light rays moving along straight lines unless they encounter a refractive medium, in which case they bend, and that's how you make lens and you generate focal points and things like that. So when is it appropriate to go from the wave optics description to the geometric optics description? Well, it's when the wavelength of the field is very small compared to anything else in the problem. You know, the size of the aperture, for example, or the size of the focal length of the lens. So you get geometric optics in this approximation where the wavelength is very small compared with any other relevant scale in the problem. So when you have a situation like this, and here I'll just assume that my light rays, well, light rays really are, you know, things that satisfy Maxwell's equations, but here I'll just do a crude job at modeling Maxwell's equations in terms of a scalar field wave equation. You had a question?
Yeah, that statement about the wavelength, just wondering if I understand it correctly. Are you saying that if a certain light has wavelength of the same scale as the radius of curvature, then the Fermat principle breaks down?
Fermat's principle, yeah, sure. Yeah, because then all the wave-like aspects of the field become important. That's when you get, you know, refraction, diffraction patterns and things like that. So I think that's, you know, that's not very surprising. Okay, so I'll just assume that we have a scalar field, which is, you know, just a crude model for the vector potential of electromagnetism that satisfies a wave equation in my curved space-time, and the wave equation is defined by making the usual flat spacetime wave equation covariant, which means that we're going to involve the metric and covariant derivatives acting on our scalar field. And here I'm going to be assuming that it's zero. If there was a mass term in the equation, I wouldn't care very much because I would assume that the wavelength is larger than that scale, so I would just get rid of it. How do we incorporate this assumption of small wavelength? Well, what we're going to say is that phi is going to be an amplitude that's going to be varying very slowly, and a phase that's going to be varying very rapidly. The wavelength is going to be small if the frequency is very high, and the frequency is going to be very high if the phase of the field varies very strongly, very rapidly compared with the amplitude. So in order to indicate this, I'll just divide the phase by a factor of 1 over epsilon, just to emphasize that this is something that varies very rapidly. And if this looks to you like WKB, well, it is just WKB. So here we have amplitude varies very slowly compared with phase. And the phase is the function s. Okay, well, let's start taking derivatives. If I differentiate phi, well, I'm going to get a derivative of a, but no epsilon. When I differentiate the phase, I'm going to get a 1 over epsilon, and that's going to be dominating. So to leading order, I'm going to get a factor of I, I'm going to get a factor of 1 over epsilon, and I'm going to get the gradient of the phase function times phi itself. And I'll stop here. You know, I could go beyond that, and that would give me a more accurate WKB approximation, but for what I want to do here, I don't need to do more than that. Okay, when I take a second derivative, well, if I wanted to be accurate, I would need to differentiate the phase twice. I would need to differentiate the amplitude again, and I would need to differentiate the exponential factor. I won't care about this guy because it comes with a factor of 1 over epsilon only. I don't care about this because this also will bring a factor of 1 over epsilon, whereas when I differentiate the exponential, I'm going to bring down another factor of 1 over epsilon. So in the at leading order, then, I'll care only about the 1 over epsilon squared term. And what I find is that at that order, we get the 1 over epsilon squared term, and we get two derivatives of the phase, multiplying the amplitude and the exponential factor. So there are higher order corrections that come with you know, relative factors of epsilon. So what do we get in the you know, for the wave equation? Well, now I just need to multiply this by the metric, and I get that the wave operator acting on phi is going to be to leading order 1 over epsilon squared, and I get this equation right here. And if I want to make, if I want to say that the wave equation is going to be satisfied, I have to make sure that every term in the expansion in 1 over epsilon be true. So each term in the expansion has to vanish independently, and we end up with the equation that's known as the Iconal equation. So, sorry, I'm losing the board here, but demanding that we satisfy the wave equation gives us what is known as the Iconal equation. And the Iconal equation is the equation that tells us that the gradient of the phase function is a null vector. And if I were to proceed with this, well, no, I have enough. Because a null vector being a gradient of a scalar function guarantees that it will satisfy the geodesic equation. So K alpha, defined as the gradient of the phase, is a null vector. It's a null vector that satisfies automatically the geodesic equation. So what are the rays? The rays are whatever is tangent to the to K. So K is a tangent vector field. What it's tangent to, of course, are the light rays. The light rays are defined in the geometric optics limit as, you know, as things that are tangent to the gradient of the phase function. So what I'm saying here is that, you know, in this crude modeling, but we could make it more sophisticated, we could actually talk about the real Maxwell equations instead of just some mock-up of it. In the geometric optics limit, when we carry out the expansion, we do get the notion that light rays emerge as something physical. They are, you know, things that can be defined in terms of the phase of the electromagnetic field. The vector k that we get by taking the gradient of the phase function is a null vector by virtue of the wave equation. It's a null vector that's a gradient that guarantees that it will satisfy the geodesic equations. And that's our statement that null rays in curved spacetime will, you know, will follow geodesics, null geodesics of the curved spacetime. But even more than that, k being the gradient of a function guarantees that we're talking here about a congruence of geodesics that is hypersurface orthogonal. So whenever you talk about light rays that can be thought of as being produced by real, honest Maxwell fields, whenever you have light rays that do emerge in this context of geometric optics approximation, well, you're pretty much guaranteed to have a hypersurface orthogonal congruence. And the hypersurfaces to which the congruence is orthogonal are just, you know, surfaces of constant phase. So that's essentially my argument to suggest that in the null case, the extra condition that we need to prove the focusing theorem, the condition that we have a hypersurface orthogonal congruence, is something that in fact comes out pretty naturally when you just think of the connection between null geodesics and, you know, massless, well, massless fields or even massive fields, but in the appropriate limit where the wavelength is very high compared with the mass or the radius of curvature or the radius of the aperture or, you know, the focal length of the lens and all of those extra scales that that may come into the problem. Yep? Well, then you're starting to probe a really wave-like, you know, situation. What you would find in that context is that, well, the notion of light rays is no longer really relevant. I mean, you really are dealing with a wave field, and you have to deal with the wave-like properties of that field face on, and there would be no, you know, no gain in trying to mimic this behavior in terms of light rays. So scattering would occur, you would have, you know, diffraction type effects, you would have all sorts of effects like that that are familiar from wave optics. And one thing also that you would get is the notion that because of all those wave-like scattering events that would take place, you would find that the propagation speed of your field would not be just the speed of light, it would actually be all speeds, you know, below the speed of light and including the speed of light. So the speed of light is the speed of propagation for the really short wavelength modes of your wave field. As you make the wavelength smaller or, you know, larger and start to make the wavelength comparable with the scale of curvature, you find that while the wave is really feeling its way around the space-time curvature, and you start generating, you know, scattering events and things like that, which means that if you want to insist in talking about propagation speed for your signal, it has to include all possible speeds up to the speed of light. And, you know, this is what happens when you deal with wave fields in curved space-time without, you know, pushing the approximation. And those can be really cool. And, you know, when you study gravitational waves, in fact, those effects can become pretty important. When you model the creation of gravitational waves by a very compact binary system, you have to imagine that the waves are propagating out of the curvature potential that's generated by the mass and the motion up to orbiting bodies. So you have a binary system, for example, of compact objects. They are sitting pretty deep in a gravitational potential. The waves have to make their way out of that. And that's a phenomenon that that involves gravitational waves with a frequency and a wavelength that are comparable to the other scales in the problem. And all of those wave-like aspects are very important if you want to get the right, you know, the right expression for the waves coming out. So, well, that's part of what I do, right? I do these calculations, and I do worry and include all of those wave-like effects that are not, you know, incorporated in the geometric optics approximation. Did you have a question? In which fields? Right. So let's see. The microwave background radiation involves radiation, of what wavelength? I forget the exact number, but it's microwave, right? So we're talking about radiation with a wavelength that's, what, a few kilometers, something like that? Or is it?
Kilometers is radio.
Sorry?
Kilometers is radio. Radio.
So what's microwave? It's
microwave.
Okay. Gee, I wish somebody could just shut off the camera when I don't know what I'm talking about. I think we're still talking about wavelengths that are pretty small, especially compared with the radius of curvature of the universe, which is the Hubble radius. So.
But I have a question. Our universe is not homogeneous. Because
I'm not exactly sure, but I think if you really wanted to handle cases like that, you would have to think about the wave-like nature of the field. And my guess is that, unless you want to model scale, structure on scales that are very short, you don't really need to worry about it. And I think, cosmic scale type calculations involve still pretty, mostly fairly large scale. So I'd have to think about this. I don't know. All right, so let's see. Any more questions about this? Okay, so just to give a sort of global orientation about all of this, I wanted to introduce the focusing theorem because I think, in the null case, because I think that's where it's really the most physically powerful, we're going to need the Ray-Chowdhury equation when we come back to black holes later on. So keep in mind that I'm building up an expertise that will be useful when we start talking about black holes. So again, I think I said that before, but the big picture is something like this. When we look at black holes in fairly general terms, we're looking at the event horizon as being the most interesting place about the black hole. The event horizon is going to be a null hypersurface. A null hypersurface, for reasons that will become a little bit clearer, but I think are pretty intuitive, a null hypersurface is defined, is defined in terms of a network of null geodesics that generates the surface. So we have this hypersurface orthogonal congruence of null geodesics that lives right on the event horizon. If we want to understand the behavior of the event horizon as a whole, it's going to be pretty important to understand the behavior of the null geodesics that generate it. And the tool to do that is going to be, in part, that equation right here. And that's an equation that, in fact, will tell us how the black hole event horizon is growing in time. So contained here is, a lot of information about the rate of growth of an event horizon when the black hole is absorbing some matter and things like that. So we'll have plenty of an opportunity to return to this equation when we put it all together and talk about black holes. But in order to get there, I want to talk about hypersurfaces because, to talk about the event horizon as a null hypersurface means that I have to flesh out more, details about what's involved with dealing with hypersurfaces in curved space-time, and that's the purpose of Chapter 3. That gives me an occasion, though, to talk about other things as well, which are pretty important and interesting, for example, the initial value problem of general relativity. So Chapter 3 is about hypersurfaces, not only the null case, which, again, involves all of those wonderful subtleties that we've encountered already. They're going to come back when we talk about null hypersurfaces. But if we talk about space-like or time-like hypersurfaces, they're simpler to describe, and there's some additional, applications of this formalism that is interesting in its own right. So in the next, 10, 15 minutes, what I want to do is to start making the transition into a description of hypersurfaces. And I'll just introduce some of the ideas now, and, well, we'll come back to that next time. Okay, so we're going into chapter 3 on hypersurfaces. And what I mean by a hypersurface, I think, is clear. It's just a three-dimensional surface in four-dimensional space-time. So a surface of codimension 1, and typically we call them hypersurfaces because we want to distinguish them from two-dimensional surfaces in three-dimensional space. Those are three-dimensional surfaces in four-dimensional space-time. So if we're going to be dealing with hypersurfaces, and here I have in mind, you know, we're going to deal with one hypersurface, and we're going to be embedding this one hypersurface in space-time, we have to come up with a mathematics to describe where the hypersurface is and what we're going to do with it. And before I, you know, do this in general in space-time, let me just, you know, introduce a very simple example of this in more familiar terms. So let's say we want to describe a two-dimensional sphere in three-dimensional space. What do we do when we want to do that? And that's really simple, but the general situation is really no more complicated than that. So let's say we have a 2D sphere in 3D flat space. So here's here's a, you know, a description of that, a graphical description of that. So here we have the z-axis, the x-axis, the y-axis. And if I want to give you the mathematical description of that surface in three-dimensional space, I can do it in, well, probably a number of ways, but I'll consider two of them. The first way is to say, so I'm going to be talking here about a surface of radius r, just to be concrete. And the first thing I can tell you is what is the condition on x, y, and z that will take me on the surface of the sphere, anywhere on the surface of the sphere. So the mathematical statement number one would be to say that there's going to be a function of x, y, and z, which is going to be a constant on the sphere. And that's the restriction on the three-dimensional coordinates that place me on the surface of the sphere. And concretely, I would say that phi might be something like x squared plus y squared plus z squared. And that would be equal to, of course, r squared if we want to be on the surface of the sphere. So that's one way of describing the sphere mathematically. And one good property of this way of describing the sphere is that it gives me a direct way to find the normal vector to the sphere, because I can calculate the normal vector by just calculating the gradient of that function and normalizing it. So if I want to calculate the normal, I would say that, well, the normal vector is going to be proportional to the gradient of the scalar function. And the gradient of the scalar function, again, not worrying about factors, is going to be proportional to x, y, and z. And if I wanted to normalize this properly, I would divide through by r, and that would give me a unit normal vector. There's another way of describing the sphere, which turns out to be useful for different reasons. What I can do to describe the sphere is to give you a mathematical description of curves that run on the sphere. And I can think of those curves as setting up a coordinate system purely on the sphere. And of course, the standard thing to do here would be to consider the curves of longitude and the curves of latitude. And we would set up a nice coordinate system on the sphere using those curves, those lines. And I don't care about coordinate singularities at the poles. You know, those are standard issues I don't care about. So the other description would be to say that that we have those curves, which are going to be, you know, our coordinate lines on the sphere. And then the instruction would be to say what x, y, and z are doing when we describe those curves. And we would parameterize that in terms of useful quantities like polar angles. So another mode of description would be to say that we have x as a function of theta and phi, the two polar coordinates that I'll introduce. And x is going to be, well, r sine theta cosine phi. Y is r sine theta sine phi. And z is r cosine theta. And as I play with theta and phi, as I let them run through their range, you know, between 0 and 2 pi for phi and between 0 and pi for theta, I'm describing those curves that I drew there. And I'm generating displacements that are purely intrinsic to the sphere. And of course, those equations are perfectly compatible with those equations there. Otherwise, we'd just be making a stupid mistake. Those equations are useful because, well, first of all, they give me a coordinate system on the sphere. And if we're going to be, you know, playing with what happens on the surface, it's going to be good to have a coordinate system to do that. And at this stage, we have two coordinate systems in our construction. We have the x, y, and z coordinates for the, you know, for the three-dimensional space, and we have the intrinsic coordinates, which are two-dimensional and defined only on the sphere, have no extension beyond the sphere that we care to introduce. So in this description, we have coordinates on the sphere. And we have a way of using those equations. So the first equation gave us a way to define a normal vector. The second set of equations gives us a way of defining tangent vectors. We can form a basis of a vectorial basis on the sphere by using those embedding relations, as they are called. So those are embedding relations. What do I mean by that? I can define, so here I'm using purely three-dimensional vector calculus language. I can define a vector on the sphere that's going to be pointing in the direction of increasing theta by differentiating the position vector with respect to theta. And you can work it out if you want to. It's going to be r times cosine theta cosine phi, r times cosine theta sine phi, and minus r sine theta. That's a vector that points in the direction of increasing theta because I'm considering here a displacement in the direction of theta by differentiating x, y, and z with respect to theta. So that's a vector that points in the direction of increasing theta. And this is a vector that's going to be pointing in the direction of increasing phi. And this is going to be equal to r sine theta sine phi, r cosine sine theta cosine phi, and 0. Those vectors are tangent to the sphere. And together with the normal vector, we have a complete basis for three-dimensional space evaluated on the sphere. So given the embedding relations, we have access immediately to a vectorial basis on the sphere. And that turns out to be useful for all sorts of reasons. Let me say a few more things about this. Suppose you want to know what is the metric on the sphere. We have a metric in three-dimensional flat space that is given to us. And what we want to know is, well, what is the metric that's going to be induced on the surface of the sphere given the metric we have in the embedding space? Well, how do we answer the question? Well, it's rather pretty simple. We consider displacements that are confined to the sphere, and you work out the S squared for those displacements, and you get your answer. For general displacements in three-dimensional space, that's the ds squared that corresponds to, you know, a change in the Cartesian coordinates, and the Kronecker delta is the Euclidean metric. If we're going to be displacing ourselves on the spheres, the displacement in x, y, and z are confined. They're restricted because on the sphere, we move only with respect to theta and with respect to phi. And if we make a displacement along theta and phi, the changes in x, y, and z are going to be given by those tangent vectors. So if we restrict the displacements to be on the sphere, what we end up with here is dx alpha re-expressed in terms of displacements along theta and phi. And same thing for dx beta, dxb. At this stage, it's useful to introduce some notation to make the notation a little bit more compact, but never mind. When you work it all out, we can gather all the terms in theta and phi. So we end up with delta AB dxA d theta dxB d theta d theta squared plus, you know, the other terms. And just by doing this, well, I can re-express this as the Euclidean metric times the components of the tangent vector, you know, in the direction of theta, plus the other terms. So having worked out those tangent vectors and looking at the inner products between those tangent vectors, we have the induced metric on the sphere. Because that coefficient right here, by definition of what we mean by a metric, is going to be g theta theta. And we're going to have the other metric components by direct calculation like that. So those equations, those embedding relations, give us the tangent vectors and the inner products in the original metric of the tangent vectors give us the induced metric. So I think in the next 5 minutes, I'll just redo all of this, but now in complete generality, not in the context of a specific example, but in a way that would be valid in, you know, for arbitrary hypersurfaces. But the story is exactly the same. So for a hypersurface in space-time, and here I don't care whether I'm talking about time-like or space-like or null. We can give two descriptions of the hypersurfaces. We can say that there's going to be a function of all the space-time coordinates that's going to be constant on the hypersurface. And that's analogous to the first description of the sphere. And that's the starting point for calculating the normal vector. So if we have that, we can immediately calculate the normal vector. And the normal vector is going to be proportional to the gradient of the scalar function. And then the proportionality constant can be figured out by just defining this as a normal vector. And, you know, I spell it out more fully in the notes. So if we want to know the normal, it's useful to start with this kind of description. Or we can go to the next phase, which is to give the embedding relations, which gives us more information about what happens directly on the hypersurface. So just to draw something, so here's a piece of my hypersurface. Typically, I call my hypersurfaces sigma. Sigma is described by the condition that phi is equal to a constant. We can draw a bunch of curves on sigma, and of course, here we have complete freedom in doing that. And we can describe those curves by giving those embedding relations. So those curves are going to be curves of constant three-dimensional coordinates y. So, you know, in the example, we had theta and phi, two coordinates in three dimensions. Here we have three coordinates in four dimensions. So YA are going to be the intrinsic coordinates. On sigma. A is going to be a three-dimensional index that's going to run from 1 to 3. And the embedding relations are going to be, it's just saying that what each space-time coordinate is going to be as a function of the intrinsic coordinates. And those are just a mathematical description of all those curves that are running on the hypersurface, curves of constant y1, y2, and y3. So we have this description, we have this description. Of course, the two descriptions must be compatible. Otherwise, we'd be doing something stupid. And once we have those relations, we can differentiate them and get tangent vectors. So this, I should have said, this is the normal. And the tangent vector. The tangent vectors, there's going to be three of them. They're going to be labeled by this index A, the same way that I was using theta and phi as labels before. And they're going to be defined to be the partial derivatives of the embedding relations. Exactly the same reasoning. And I know that this tangent to the surface because when I change y, any one of them, I'm producing a displacement that's purely within the hypersurface. So those vectors are guaranteed to be tangential to the hypersurface, and therefore they're going to be orthogonal to n. Those are the tangent vectors. And the final thing that I'll say is that, well, how do we get the induced metric? We follow exactly the same procedure. We start out with the statement that in space-time, we have a metric G alpha beta, and we can consider arbitrary displacements as expressed, you know, in terms of the original coordinate system, the one that exists in the whole space-time. But if we say that we're going to be restricting our displacements to the hypersurface, we're going to say that, well, x can change only you know, in a way that's compatible with those equations right here. So x will change only if we're displacing ourselves within the hypersurface, which means that y will be changing. And that's expressing each of the coordinate derivatives here in terms of partial derivatives with respect to the intrinsic coordinates. So we have that, and we have this. We recognize the partial derivatives as being the components of our tangent vectors. So we have the metric multiplying vector A with vector B, dyA, dyB. And we know that the coefficient in front of the coordinate displacements must be the metric that lives purely on the hypersurface. The intrinsic metric, the induced metric on the hypersurface, is the thing that will translate coordinate displacements into real physical displacements in space-time. And therefore, that combination here must be the induced metric, which I'll call HAB. So what we have then is that for displacements on the hypersurface, we have a metric HAB that converts displacements in the y coordinate system into real physical distances in space-time, and HAB, we get it from the metric, the four-dimensional metric, by taking inner products between all the tangent vectors. And already we've come a long way to talking about hypersurfaces in curved space-time. I haven't said anything about whether the hypersurface is time-like, space-like, or null. And in fact, at this stage, I don't need to distinguish between the various cases. Whether or not the surface is whether the surface is time-like, space-like, or null is something that would be revealed by the norm, by the length of that vector. So if the normal is time-like, then the hypersurface is space-like. If the normal is space-like, the surface is time-like. If the vector is null, the surface is null, right? And we're back in, you know, the old story about having the normal vector being tangent to the surface. So in the null case, there's those extra subtleties, but they don't show up when I do all of this. All of that is valid regardless of the signature of the hypersurface. If I want to deal with null hypersurfaces, though, it's going to be useful, and we're going to do that next time, to introduce a specific notation to handle the null case, to distinguish, you know, the null direction on the hypersurface and the orthogonal directions that are, you know, the transverse two-dimensional directions that we've talked about, this morning. So we'll do all of that. We'll specialize the notation specifically to the null case when we need to deal with that specifically. And we'll do that next time. Another thing that I'm going to tackle on next time is, you know, now that we have a surface, and now that we know how to define a metric on that surface, how do we formulate integration? So how do we define integration on hypersurfaces? What are volume elements on the hypersurface? For the time-like case and space-like case, the answer is very simple, because once you have the metric, you do the usual thing and take the determinant of that metric, and that gives you a volume element on the surface. When you're dealing with the null case, none of that works, because in this case, the metric becomes two-dimensional. The determinant of a 3x3 matrix with a zero eigenvalue is zero, and the usual construction just fails completely. So how to do integration on null hypersurfaces is going to be, you know, another place where all those wonderful subtleties show up, and we'll deal with them next time. And the reason why I need this, of course, is that at some point I'll want to integrate over the event horizon, talk about the flux of mass across the event horizon, for example. That will involve an integration, and we need to have the tools to do that. All right, so I think that's enough for today. Thank you.